what the heck is going on with the... Oh, there. The Commodore 64 woke up.
There we go.
Jeez.
Mick, whatever you did to it last night, it's not cool.
I don't know what happened here last night. What show was on here last night?
Sick Mick. It was a strange show last night. Kept me up past my bedtime. I was like afraid to turn it off. Crazy things.
You should know better than to listen to this radio station.
I'm starting to see that. It's scary sometimes at night in this place. See, what's weird about Mick is they actually live stream, so you can see them while you hear them, and it's like...
What do they look like?
Like normal. They look normal. They're not, but they look normal.
Like 2-3 individuals?
Four.
Four?
Mick, Keith, Mike, and Eric.
And you know their names?
It took me a couple weeks, but yes. I'm not good with names, but yes, I finally figured them out. And I figured out who's who, you know, because I made them, like, wave on camera. There was incense burning and blow-up dolls and people, hosts from other stations calling. It was a very, very confusing evening.
So where's the webcam? I don't see anything here.
They bring their own in, and then they bring it in and then take it out. I don't know if they use a phone. I don't know how they do it, but they're on Ustream. When their show broadcasts Wednesdays from 8 to 11, they also live stream it on Ustream.tv, so it's like interactive radio.
Well, who wants that?
Apparently people from all over the world. They have like a listener in England who calls. She stays up late on Wednesday nights just to listen and call in. Wendy. And like all over the country. A girl from Texas called in last night.
I need to talk to a normal person. That would be Dennis Mailey, the editor of the BradenandTimes.com. A guy that has substance. A guy that is grounded.
Dennis, he just says that because you can whoop him.
Hey, Dennis.
Hey, buddy. I got two ex-wives that would disagree with all that, but go ahead. I appreciate it.
Oh, two ex-wives. That just gives you much more you have more character, Dennis. It makes you a more interesting person.
Hey, writers have a higher divorce rate than police officers.
There's an interesting piece of psychology.
Yeah.
So basically what you're telling me is you're harder to live with than a cop.
Yep.
Wow.
And they're not easy.
Jeez. I thought he was okay.
He is okay.
Well, he's okay, but I mean... Well, at least I don't have to be married to him, so it's...
Nothing like
even with marriage equality, I would never consider that.
Poor Dennis calls in and gets psychoanalyzed. You just never know what's going to happen to you on Thursday mornings, do you?
No, I don't. But you know what? It's good.
Dennis, I guess while we're out here on the edge, I have to tell you, I think you need to bring back the photo on the Bradenton Times with the fedora. I mean, that...
I actually get that quite a few times from people that say that they missed the fedora picture, so maybe we'll have to break that back out.
Just that smiling... Good old boy thing is the old the fedora, man. Jack Abramoff with honesty is what I see.
See, and I like the picture without the hat.
Well, I guess if the women like it, that's what you got to go with.
I wouldn't say I'm the women, but I'm a woman, singular. I like it. I don't know. It's
well. Anyway, you've been on a theme this week in the BradentonTimes.com. Last Sunday you had When College Becomes a Risky Investment, and then you followed it up this Thursday with Are We Facing a Student Loan Bubble? And while I'm at it, I probably should say you should sign up for the semi-weekly newsletter so that you don't miss any of these important columns. But let's go back to Sunday, and what were you going after when you said college becomes a risky investment?
Well, you know, this is where I started. As happens sometimes, to give you a little idea how I do my column, I take a lot of subjects that are kind of brewing, and I'll open a folder for them, and then depending on whether it's a time-sensitive issue will depend on, you know, how quickly I get to it. And sometimes I'll put one away, and I'll just keep reading some data on it, and I'll, you know, make notes to it and come back to it. So the college one had been interesting to me for a long time because it's one of those things, when you look at economics, there are two things in our society that the inflationary rate has been astronomical on, and that's been healthcare and college. And believe it or not, college has been a little bit higher than healthcare. And they both outpace normal inflation by about 300%. So when you look at that, you say, wow, you look at a chart, and you can't do that very long. You know, so that's why they're both becoming big problems, because when you look at earnings and how flat they've been for so long, and then you look, you know, there are ways you can overcome normal inflation, even with flat earnings, by changing the kind of goods you buy. But when something that's a necessity, and, you know, college has always been viewed by most people as a necessity, and healthcare certainly is, when they become so inaccessible because of that inflation, you have to do something. It becomes an everyday problem when that arc goes that high. So one of the things I've been looking at is with college inflation, how, and the data on recent college students. You know, when you look at college students right now, more than half of them, almost half of them are unemployed if they've graduated in the last 2 years. More than half of them are either unemployed or working in a field, you know, like waiting tables, working at Starbucks, that does not require a degree. And then when you look on top of it, the inflationary rate, how many more students are borrowing, which is more than double our borrowing that happened just a couple decades ago as far as taking out loans to finance their education. You look at that and you have to start asking the question, at what point does it become financially a bad investment to go to college that it's not likely to pay off? And there's a lot of data now. You know, obviously I went to college. I'm a big proponent of people getting education. I think there's an intrinsic value to higher education that really can't be measured just with, you know, that data. But at the same time, you have to start saying, what is it doing when we are asking people to take on mountains of debt and really putting them in a situation where they're staring, you know, into the future and saying, well, there's no real likelihood that I'm going to be able to pay this off. And there's an argument you can start to make now that, you know, at least for recent graduates, there's a lot made across the spectrum when people say, well, you know, the unemployment rate for college graduates is only half what it is for, you know, the population at large. And that's true, but that's really skewed by the broader economy, the people that got degrees 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Yes, they fared better in the Great Recession in terms of remaining employed. Now, a lot of them have been devalued, and they've had to take other positions. A lot of them have had to take pay cuts. But, you know, their unemployment levels have been about half, or just under 5% as opposed to just under 10%. But when you look at recent college graduates, that trend is certainly changing. So what we're seeing is that while it's helped you weather the storm if you're already in the workforce, entering the workforce, college degrees have done really nothing for people. And there's almost the argument that it's done less for you, because these jobs were traditionally you're entering without a lot of experience and a lot of productivity right away. There's not a willingness to invest in those first couple of years where they're kind of subsidizing your career, especially when there are so many more experienced people out there unemployed. So that's something we really got to look at.
Robin, you looked at this for yourself, didn't you?
What's that?
The cost of college versus what you could make.
Yes. Mr. Davis and I, we'd gotten to a point where I was considering going to college, and when we sat down, did the numbers of having to work and go to school, the loans that would accumulate, the number of years it would take to pay off, it was not a smart financial investment for us. And
yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we're looking at it from two different angles right now, because there's me, who's almost 40, and it's like, okay, how many years would it be till I was actually at work? How many years would it take to pay off those loans? What would the potential income be? We also have our oldest, our son, is looking at med school as a possibility. And his top three at the moment are...
Med school?
He's in the early stages of his college career, so he's still figuring it out. And his top three are ophthalmology, oncology, and completely random and out of left field compared to those two, journalism. And, you know, and he's not a stupid kid, and he's obviously not. He's considering med school. He's sitting there going, okay, which one am I going to make money at? I think in a perfect world, he wants to be like a novelist. You know, he has like all these ideas, but then he's like, I can't make money doing that. And he's really, really cognizant and realistic of the fact that how am I going to be able to get into the workforce and actually make enough money to pay my loans?
Dennis, you coming down on med school or journalism?
You know, at this point, obviously the one of the few growth fields all across the board is medicine and healthcare. So that's one of the few things that can't be outsourced as easily. And but at the same time, obviously people are looking in most cases at taking mountains of debt out to accomplish that. So that's the question to ask is, you know, whether somebody wants to be saddled with that. What you're seeing a couple things with is you're seeing men going into non-traditional fields. You're seeing a lot more men going into nursing. You're seeing, you know, and that was one of the other areas where a lot of student loan debt has accumulated, that you have had a lot of long-term unemployed looking at it and saying, well, maybe I should go back to school. And where a lot of them have you know, there's this whole other thing going on with the for-profit colleges. You see these places like DeVry and Lincoln Tech, you know, there's 1,000 of them, and they're popping up everywhere. You know, if you look in Manatee County, there, I think, have been 5 of them in the last about 7 years, your University of Phoenix and so forth, that have popped up, and most of them are over, you know, east of the interstate, in the Lakewood Ranch area. And these private for-profit ones are who's snagging up a lot of the adults reentering. A lot of them, you know, take that argument and say, you know, I need to go back and make myself more marketable and get a degree. I've sat down with a couple people in the last couple of years who've asked my advice on it and did the math, just like Robin said, and looked at it and said, okay, you know, let's look at a couple of years, and especially if they weren't going to be able to work full-time through that, let's look at taking you out of the workforce for a couple of years and the earnings you would have earned, and then let's look at putting you back in even above the average starting salary for somebody with a bachelor's degree, and let's look at how many years you'd have to do to become flush. And in most cases, they're near retirement, you know, if they're 40 years old.
That's the number. That's exactly the number I came up with, Dennis. I would be into my 60s. Now, I was looking at a law degree, so we're talking 7 years of college. It's not just a 2 or 4 year degree.
Right.
But we were looking at, I would probably, until I got through college, started to practice, I would be well into my 60s before the loans were paid off, if not close to 70. And I'm like, so at the end of the day, my net, you know, my net improvement in my income was exactly zero.
Yeah, hey, that's another interesting one. You know, I spoke to a girl when I was doing the research for this who had just graduated law school about 2 years ago, and that is one where, you know, they're really hurting because, you know, she's coming out with mountains of debt. She went to a state school, University of Florida, and then went to Tulane for law, and she had her student loan payment, she said, was $940 a month.
Wow.
And, you know, her starting salary, she got hired with one of the best firms in the area, probably the top firm in Sarasota, and her starting salary was $45,000. And she was thrilled to get on with them.
And that's that's really not a shabby salary, but when you're looking at $1,000 in loan debt,
you know,
that hurts.
That's like a mortgage on top of your apartment. So, I mean, she was part of the working poor at that point. I mean, it was really staggering to see that.
Was she a traditional age student?
She was.
Okay,
yeah.
And that would
put her. She had 2 years between law school, so she was maybe 29.
I was just going to say,
so
that would put her around 30, a time in people's lives when they want to be buying a house and they're looking at family stuff and they're getting into that. My sister's
absolutely.
One of those.
The idea of having children and stuff was not even, you know, within the realm of possibilities because of that.
Right, and then she's going to age out. My sister's in the flip side. You know, we have my stepson's going into it. How do I pay it off? Well, my sister went in during the days when we weren't thinking about these things, and she ended up her bachelor's took her 5 years. She had to change majors, and so she comes out of college, you know, 5 years of college, goes into the workforce for a couple of years, and realizes she can't pay her student loans and she can't get a job that pays, you know, working. And her only choice, which was a horrific financial decision, is she went back to school. She's getting a third degree. She's going to go into teaching. And even
seeing that a lot.
And teaching was always in the background. She's a music major, so I mean, it was always kind of like, eventually I'm going to end up teaching. But the because of that, having to change her major, which was due to a health issue, she could no longer be a performance major. She switched her major, substitute taught for a year, worked here, worked there, and went, crap, I can't pay my loans. And she and I had a long talk, and I said, you are making the dumbest financial decision. She said, I have no other choice. She said, my hands are literally tied. I cannot work enough hours to make the money to pay these loans. So she's going back, and she's going to come out a teacher, and thankfully in the Northeast, teachers are paid pretty well, so she should actually be in a position where she can pay her loans, but she's going to be paying those loans probably till she's 50.
This is a total sidebar story here, but maybe somebody else is out there and would relate to it. You know, I was on the 17-year program for a college degree, and I wound up graduating in 96, and I had student loans. And this is something that is actually very common, that, you know, I paid off my loan, and then all of a sudden I started getting these calls. I, you know, you're in default on your student loan. I'm like, I paid it. And there is this stuff that happens. I talked to an attorney, and she says this happens a lot. They resell loans. They just ledger it back on the books and resell it.
The commercial loans are very, very scary things. Higher interest rates, very aggressive collection. My grandfather actually co-signed some of my sister's loans, and after he passed away, they called her, same kind of thing, saying she was late. She wasn't. And she said, you know, let me check my, I don't even remember all the details, but I think it was like, let me check my books because I'm pretty sure I sent the payment. And if not, I'll get it right in the mail. We had a death in the family. And then they said, well, we're going to call your co-signer because your payment's late. And she said, well, that's the person who passed away. And they didn't so much as pause to say, I'm sorry for your loss. They got really nasty with her about, well, since he's dead, it's all on your back and you better be responsible. And they were very, very vicious with her. And, you know, I had to make a call in regards to my grandparents' death. I had to cancel subscriptions that I got for them as gifts. And these people were just, we're very sorry for your loss, no problem. You know, very nice about it. They were at least courteous. The student loan people, she was in tears by the time she hung up that phone call, because here we've just lost our grandfather. She's even like, I may not have mailed the check. She's, you know, there's so much going on. It was one payment. And the response of, too bad he's dead. Let's move on. It was horrible. She said the way they treat people is just like you're lower than dirt.
Yeah, they actually refunded money at the because I overpaid. And then 3 or 4 years later, I'd start getting these bills that they just somehow they just ledgered it back on and sold it off to somebody.
You know, let's look at two things that are happening as a result of this. When you look at the economy at large, one of the biggest problems you have is these kids that are coming out of college, they're supposed to be our growth class. So they're supposed to be the people that are buying homes. They're supposed to be the people that are getting married, having kids, filling closets, buying cars, doing all the things that keep a consumption-based economy growing. But when you have them increasingly, up to 85% polled this year said they'll move in with their parents when they graduate in May, right now. And when you look at that, and they're moving in with mom and dad, and they're eating off a dollar board at McDonald's, and they're working at Starbucks, what that does to the economy at large is huge, because you're taking out these people that are traditionally your better earners and your top consumers. Now, on top of it, what started to scare me as I was collecting the information for this was I kept coming back to a subject. In fact, I talked about this with Henry, I think, a year or two ago, was the student loan bubble. And, you know, economists started murmuring about this in about 2010, where they were saying, wow, there is a tremendous amount of debt going out in student loan. That level is rising to such high historic levels that it's getting frightening. Right now, we've just crossed $1 trillion in student loan debt in the United States. And there's a lot that makes this frighteningly comparable to the mortgage meltdown. And one of them is what we were just talking about, that the onset of this bad decision doesn't happen right away. When you think about mortgages, one of the flaws to all that cheap money floating around through the system was that you had an incentive for everybody to sell a home. And the thing about selling a home is that with all these exotic products like the ARM loan, the interest-only loan, you could sell a loan and mask the fact that it was a bad loan for quite some time, in some cases up to 5 years, and make it where, hey, this is going to be affordable, but it's never going to pay off. And you can look at it and say, look, this guy making $40,000 a year is never going to be able to own this $300,000 home, but he can pay the interest on it for a couple years at some really low teaser rate, and then hopefully he can just sell it or refi, or he'll be making more money down the road. But I don't care, because if I'm the mortgage officer, if I'm the loan officer, if I'm the real estate agent, if I'm any of those people involved in the early part, the housing developer, everybody, I get paid long before that happens. And that gets kicked down the road. It's the bondholder, you know, and the bank that eventually owns it. You know, it's whoever has this mortgage when things go sideways that's going to have to pay for that. That's really bad business for the economy at large, because everybody who's supposed to be making a good decision isn't incentivized to do that. You know, it's kind of the same way that, you know, stocks get traded on Wall Street. And too much in our economy is tracing back to this sort of, you know, ethos where if it doesn't matter to me, you know, because I'm still getting paid. So what I'm incentivized to and rewarded for is to make as many bad decisions as possible. Now, with student loans, the same thing. They're you know, put off until somebody graduates, and 6 months later, in most cases. And you have somebody where nobody's looking. Ideally, you have an underwriter saying, okay, this person, not is this person a good credit risk? What's their credit score? What's their previous history of repaying debt? But looking at it, saying, is there just any realistic way that you have somebody going, you know, I pick on a little bit of these private schools in the Northeast. I'm sure Robin's very familiar with them. You know, in Pennsylvania, we have 260 colleges. And, you know, there are some of them that, you know, we have the 13 or 14 state system of colleges that are very low tuition and much more affordable. You have Penn State, you have Temple, you have Pitt, these state-associated ones. But then you have a litany of not for-profit but private schools, you know, like Susquehanna and Lehigh and, you know, these different ones.
Oh,
and
Lehigh
some of them
become so expensive.
Right.
I mean,
you look at Lehigh, though. Lehigh, their education pays. It's an elite engineering school.
Yes.
A degree from Lehigh. You know, if you look at the Ivy League schools, there are schools like that that traditionally are very expensive but confer a tremendous amount of employability and marketability as an employee. But there's a lot of other ones that don't. You know, you look at ones that are just private but not necessarily exclusive academically, like Combing, you know, these schools that are, you know, $24,000 a year, Lackawanna, that you'll come out with $100,000 in debt, or at least half of that if you don't have student aid and, you know, some parents and savings and different stuff like that. But these students are increasingly coming out with tons of debt from these schools, and they're no more employable than if they go to, you know, state university. You know, so when you look at this, and nobody's underwriting that way and say, okay, here's a person that, you know, yeah, maybe they're a good credit risk if they go back to school, but what is the odds? You know, let's look at their academic performance. Nobody looks at that loan underwriting, but that would make sense if, you know, if they're buying a car or something else where the loss was more immediately felt by all the people involved in the decision. They would say, what's this person's grade like? Are they likely to get through 4 years of school? And are they going to graduate with better than a, you know, 2.0 GPA that they're employable? And once they do, what's the degree in? Oh, it's in social work, but they go to a private university. If they have $50,000 in student loans for social work, is that going to pay off? What are the starting salaries on average? You know, that's the kind of underwriting that should be done to make a good decision on a financial product, but it's not. It's just everybody pretty much qualifies, especially for the 90% that are federal loans. So you just fill out the form, and those things are never considered. So right now what we're doing is we're looking at this economy, and we're not saying, wait a minute, we have $1 trillion in existing debt. We have 2 years of people entering the workforce that aren't getting jobs in their field. So let's not forget, you know, every time that we get an employment report every month from the Department of Labor, and they say, oh, we added 115,000 jobs, that's good, or we added 75, not as good. What they don't tell you is 150,000 people enter the workforce every single month. So really, that's where the number starts at. At 150,001 jobs, you've really absorbed one. And when you remember that we lost 3.5 million jobs even before the big meltdown, you know, that we're still about 3 million jobs short in the economy, that about 2.5-3 million jobs short from the Great Recession, up to about 5 when you look at, when you say what they've been replaced with lower wages, when you look at you know, the real effect on the economy, it's really about 5 million jobs when you average out the wages that we're missing in the economy. And then you say 150,000 more coming in every month. We really have to add about 1 million jobs a month for several years before we'd ever, you know, close that gap. So when you look at that and say our economy has so many marginally employed, underemployed, unemployed, educated people in it, and then we're adding to it every year, and we have $1 trillion in debt, there is very likely going to be a tipping point coming where the mass defaults are. And the default rates, that's the canary in the coal mine, the default rates have gone up drastically in very recent months. So you look at that and you say, this is kind of like when we started having that, wow, this percentage of people aren't making the first payment on their loan. And now all of the products behind supporting the debt start to fall apart. They become not as attractive. Less investors want to get into them as they get riskier. And the ones who do expect a much greater return. So then the interest rate, the charge on it, becomes not cheap money anymore. And then the demand dries up and nobody's going. We might see a scenario in the next 2 years where that happens, and then we have a mass, you know, default, and then we have schools closing, because schools are riddled with these legacy costs, you know, tenured employees, infrastructure. You know, most of it's the physical plan, the school, that's where the grades expense, healthcare. They're not things you can cut real quick. So you might have closings of some of these colleges that just can't stay open. And that, you know, we really are looking at the mortgage industry in 2006, 2005. And we're starting to see those whispers that could become a scream very quickly. And a lot of people were ringing the bell back then, and nobody in the power of the changing were listening because they're too busy raking in money and saying, well, if it's all going to come down, I might as well get as much as I can. And there's good indication that that's what we're seeing right now.
Dennis, where do you think this is going? What happens if this explodes on us? What happens to our education system? What happens to our young workforce?
The education system could very well change as we know it. You know, you could very well have where going to college goes from something that pretty much anybody can do to something that goes back to being, you know, a tool of the privileged class. And that there was a time in this country, really before the GI Bill and everything, if you look back in the World War II, the pre-World War II era, it was, you know, most people would laugh it off. You say, well, you go to college, you laugh, and say, you know, my family's not rich, you know, there's no college in my future. There was a time where the accessibility was, you know, almost nil. But the problem, what we're learning, is that providing accessibility alone isn't the answer. You can't just say, you know, and I say in the article, look, politicians who think that, hey, well, all, and this is, you know, tends to be the liberal democratic philosophy, that all we need to do is get a lot of people to agree, an educated workforce will get us out of this. They're on the right track, because I'll tell you what, what will happen to the workforce when we stop college education on the scale we have is that we'll have a much less dynamic one, and they'll have much less skilled, and they'll be much less competitive in the global marketplace. So that will be a tremendous, tremendous weight on the economy, a downward depressing effect on the economy. But the solution isn't to take a whole, you know, millions of Americans and put them up to their eyeballs in debt so they can get this piece of paper. If you're not fixing the structural things in the economy that say it's going to pay off as an investment. So what you could see is the very idea of secondary education go back to being a very exclusive thing in our economy, because just like home, the demand for, or excuse me, the supply for finance for it will reach what should be the true demand in the economy.
His friends call him Mr. Sunshine.
Rarely good news.
He's the editor of the BradentonTimes.com. By the way, you can catch our show on demand there, usually about midday. And we appreciate that, of course, from all the fine people over there at the BradentonTimes.com.
Every day at 1 o'clock, the podcast article comes up. And then also, that's also recapped in our weekly recap. So another thing you can get in there and go back and see the old shows.
Before we let you go, Dennis. The clerk of the circuit court has—I don't think he's completed the audit of what's gone on at the commissary of the Port Manatee jail. But what's the latest on that?
Well, they have said they're going to have to extend the timeline on it. But I guess the good news you'd say is they have found no evidence of the embezzlement at the commissary. So that was the big allegation that came up in that work form internal affairs investigation. When they turned it over, they were basically waiting for some interpretations on some different laws and for some of the people from the Department of Justice to get back to them. But they have been able to at least say, you know, we found no evidence whatsoever of the embezzlement.
Okay. Well, let's hope that remains the same. Dennis, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You got it. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Dennis. It's a terrifying time to be a college student. Like, really terrifying.
It's a terrifying time to be 55. It's like,
you know, actually, you know, Mr. Davis and his son, we've got both ends of the spectrum, and I think I'd rather be 55 than 25 right now.
Really?
The young Mr. Davis is just in his first year of college, first or second year of college. He's at Palm Beach County Community right now, you know, getting his 2 years out of the way. And Mr. Davis is rapidly approaching the 55 mark, and I've talked to both of them. I know what scares both of them, and if I had to choose, honestly, I think I'd rather be 55 in this economy than 25 with no hope of a job.
Mr. Davis has skills.
Everybody has skills, you know, and he is. He's very blessed.
Mr. Davis has real skills.
He's very talented in an industry that is in very high demand in Florida. So, yeah, he has good skills. And he's scared to death, though, because his retirement has deflated over the years because of the stock market. All of his retirements were in the stock market, like many people's, and they're not worth anything. But the uncertainty, and, you know, we've actually changed our approach. 3 years ago, we sat down with the young Mr. Davis and said, you've got to go to college. You have to go to college in this economy. And now, talking to him, you know, about cost versus payoff, the kid's right. You know, and he's dead right. And I've told him that, and I've said, but now, granted, he also doesn't have the mechanical skills his dad has, so chances are he does need a college education. He's more of a academic than his, where his father's more mechanical. But with the other two kids who have not started college yet, we're going to have a much different approach of sitting down and talking to them and saying, what do you really want to do, and are you going to be able to pay for it, unless something like Dennis talks about. Something's got to change or this system's going to blow up. Thankfully, young Mr. Davis is currently on Pell Grants, so for the moment, he's covered. But if he talks med school, if he really goes that route, it's a lot of loans to rack up. We have to be real certain that he can pay it off, and sadly, we're not in a position to pay for college. We really aren't.
Well, I've got my eye on a couple of corners around the city here where I think I can panhandle pretty well. And
gotta go to the Keys. I've heard that panhandlers in the Keys make like $500 a week.
Well, that doesn't sound too good.
To sit around and do nothing? Most of whom aren't homeless?
Panhandling is hard work. You're out there in the sun.
I don't bring home $500 a week, so I'm thinking it's a, you know, increase.
I don't know.
The average person doesn't bring home $500 a week, so they're making pretty good, you know, pretty good coin there.
I'm going to have to grow my beard out a little bit, I guess. Oh, well. More of this after the break. Oh, we got a call. You're live on the air.
Yes, John from Sarasota.
Hey, John. Get a good corner for me where I think, you know, I can make a decent living panhandling.
Well, I've always said that, you know, invest in vintage psychedelic concert posters.
You're not biased, though, John, right?
I can prove that there's a lot of money in that, but my friend just added. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, nostalgia sells. I mean, people love that stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, many times I bought stuff for $1 a piece and sold them for $25 a piece, or I paid $100 and sold it for $1,000. Not always, but it happens, and stuff keeps going up. It never goes down in value. But that's not really why I called. I think if a person was smart, the best thing they could do... I hear a bunch of background noise. Is that okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, something's moving around. It's really making a lot of noise in my ear.
I didn't know what it was.
Audio hallucination.
Okay, I think the best thing to do would be to move to a different state. I think Florida is one of the worst. In fact, statistics show that it is. It is one of the worst places to work. And, you know, like my daughter, who just turned 40, decided, less than a year ago she turned 40, she decided to go to nursing school.
How old are you, John?
I was just going to say, for those of you who have not met John, he looks about 40.
Yeah.
So when you say you have a daughter that's 40, I'm like, were you procreating in kindergarten or what?
Yeah, I mean, did you have some game when you were 10 years old?
Wow. Thank you for the compliment. But no, I was married when I was just a couple weeks before my 18th birthday. And my daughter was born shortly after that, 9 months after that. So so anyways, you put it all together, I'm going to be 61 pretty soon.
Wow.
But anyway, I got off track.
All that math, we confused you. Sorry.
Oh no, that's okay. Yeah, my daughter doesn't think about the student loan. She's just going for it, and she's in debt up to her ears. But you know what? You can't let everything scare you. She's going for it. She's going to nursing school, and she's halfway there. And she, any place but Florida, you can make money as a nurse. You know.
I was just going to say that it is. I have nurses in the family, and they do make excellent money. If you can get a job, nursing is not a bad place to be. And if you're a nurse with a master's degree, so much the better.
Yeah, yeah. Because even my my wife is a therapist with a master's and a couple of masters, and she she can barely make a living here in Florida. It's just unbelievable. The wages are so poor here. But anyway, that's my two cents worth. And thank you for the show.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye.
I'm shocked to find out he's 61. Although I think back in the back of my brain, I knew that I've met John in person.
Well,
he does not look 61. Let me tell you, and he does not look old enough to have a 40-year-old daughter.
I've seen him trucking down Manatee Avenue with the Soto Parade, whatever that run is they have right before the parade, and he moves pretty good for.
Does he wear his kilt?
I can't remember.
Again, for those of you, John wears a kilt, and let me tell you, he rocks the look. You know, Mr. Davis is now aware of that, and he's, sort of kind of concerned. He's like, that kind of looks comfortable. I'm like, I bet it is. But, you'd have to talk to John, not me.
Great when you go through the checkout line at the airport. You're listening to The Henry Rain Show.
The Village of the Arts is a vibrant community of artists living, creating, and working together in Bradenton, Florida. The Village of the Arts is Florida's largest art community and is home to galleries, studios, cafes, healing arts, jewelry, fashion, and books. Located just south of downtown Bradenton, the Village is one of Bradenton's most exciting areas. There are lots of great events coming up, and you can find more details at villageoftheart.com.
The Manatee County Cultural Alliance is your nonprofit information center for the arts. We are home to two galleries, educational opportunities, and a variety of events.
Arts and Eats Restaurant and Gallery will open in the Village of the Art this summer. It will feature Chef Jim Kopening's freshly made gourmet foods celebrating global flavors and Donna Slossy's broken china mosaics.
Arts Desire is an exciting contemporary fashion boutique featuring unique clothing, accessories, and jewelry. One-of-a-kind, hand-painted fabulous fashions for women of all ages.
This Village of the Arts message is proudly sponsored by attorney Jim Delgado.
Hi, I'm Dennis Maley, editor of the BradentonTimes.com, your local online daily newspaper from Manatee County. Everyone knows the future of the media is on the web, and the BradentonTimes.com is the first and only local newspaper published exclusively online. Check out our events coverage and find out what's happening in Palmetto, Bradenton, and Lakewood Ranch, and beyond. The Times is your best source to keep up with local politics and know what issues are impacting your quality of life in Manatee County before it's too late. There's also local sports coverage like high school football, SCF, local fishing guides, and the Bradenton Marauders. Read about unique people in your community, new restaurants, and for political junkie, there's tons of exclusive editorials and columns analyzing state, local, and national politics. Check us out at www.thebradentontimes.com and sign up for our free weekly recap delivered to your inbox every Thursday morning. Thebradentontimes.com, fact-based news and analysis without an agenda.
I tried to be a good wife, but he needed to do something about his problem. It's not like he was the first man to deal with ED. There are solutions, like Viagra and Cialis. I begged him to go to the doctor, but he always found an excuse not to go. Finally, I told him he had to go. He came back with a prescription, and I thought our problems were solved. That is, until we found out that they can cost up to $22 a pill. He said, no way can we afford that. Then we found out about Save On Med. With their relationships with licensed pharmacies in the U.S., Canada, and New Zealand, they were able to find generic Cialis and Viagra for just $5 a pill. That's right, just $5 a pill when you buy a package of 32. Smaller packages are available at other prices, and they're mailed right to your home. They also help people save up to 75% off the prices of heart, cholesterol, cancer, and thousands of other medicines. Give them a call at 727-388-6939. That's 727-388-6939. Save On Med solved our problem, and they can solve yours. Now, you'll have to excuse me. Oh, honey, where are you? I have something you need to take care of.
Save On Med. Call 727-388-6939. That's 727-388-6939.
Henry Rain Show with Robin Davis here at WWPR 1490 AM. And, well, people can't wait to get on the phone lines, 941-745-1490, 941-745-1490. You're live on the air.
Good morning, Henry. How are you today?
Oh, about as good as I ever am.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
How are you, Lawrence?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for asking. Henry, I understand, and I'd love, I'm curious, before I get my question, John, very interesting. That's John, your last caller?
Yes.
What does he do for a living? Do you know?
I think he sells psychedelic posters.
Interesting. Okay, it's good that
sounds pretty lucrative.
It's good that he has the time to leisure and listen to the radio while he has that kind of business. That's good. Very good for him.
Yeah. What do you do for a living, Lawrence?
I'm retired. And, Henry, I was wondering about, I understand that Alan Grayson's in town, or will be in town, in St. Petersburg?
Tuesday, June 5th, 7 p.m. at the Marriott on Roosevelt Boulevard in St. Petersburg.
Oh, well, that's very timely. Thank you for that information. Alan Grayson being one of the 1%, without question, I was wondering what kind of person or crowd would he draw? Any opinion on that?
Well, I think he would probably draw people that appreciate how he defended whistleblowers on the corruption in the Iraq War and recovered money for the federal government from people that embezzled and stole. So I that's what I think.
You wouldn't find those Wall Streeters there paying tribute to a definite one percenter.
Paying tribute? You use some of the strangest terminology.
Is he a one percenter or not?
I don't know. I don't know his financial record status. He's very accomplished.
Is,
yeah. But you know what?
No, no. He's well over $30 million in wealth. And
so someone who's wealthy can't do the right thing? Can't talk about the right
thing? Oh, no. I would agree there. But the point
her name's
is,
Robin.
Is a Wall Street... advocate. You know that, do you remember that group? That was the group that was out there that was so relevant?
Actually, Lawrence, I think you should probably check your dictionary. A Wall Street advocate would be somebody who is supportive of Wall Street. Just saying, according to Mr. Webster. But, you know, you can double check me on that by using the dictionary. Give it a shot.
He's gone now.
I know, but he's still listening. I honestly do not know. I mean, I've never sat down and looked at a list and figured that out. And, you know, in my opinion, I've never been a big fan. I'll be honest with you. I've never been a fan of the 1%, 99% because, you know, how much money you have is not necessarily indicative of where your morals and your ethics lie. You know, Warren Buffett, who is...
He's a 1%er.
If he's like the 1%er. I'm fairly certain in the United States he's in like the top 3 or something. I mean, the guy's worth a small... He's worth more than most countries. And here's a guy who's saying fair taxation and fair laws and isn't handing his children a silver spoon. So, like I said, I've never been a fan of that 99.1% routine because...
I bet those kids go to probate, though.
You can be a...
I would.
I honestly, from the interviews I've seen with the kids, I do not expect that to happen. He has raised some pretty, it seems, decent children who understand that they have high-class, high-end education and have no reason to live off daddy's money. But we're off... You know, my point was... There's people like him, Buffett, Grayson. There's other people out there who have money who understand that just because they have money, it doesn't make them special, and just because they have money, they don't deserve to pay less taxes.
I'm not that good a person. I would be in probate. By the way, speaking of good...
You should probably go to church then. I don't know. You know, ask Jesus what he thinks.
I do. I still go to probate.
I'm pretty sure
too.
Jesus wouldn't have gone to probate.
It's Wade.
Hey, Wade.
Good morning, Wade.
Good morning, folks. Listen, I just wanted to help Lawrence out a little bit. I happen to know from some personal references that Alan Grayson was from New York. He graduated from a very prestigious school, the Bronx High School of Science. His parents were school teachers, and I have a relative that knew them. And they helped set up, they were instrumental in setting up the Teachers Association Union. That has a very good record throughout the history of education. So that's just a little point that might be of interest. I'm sure it could be looked up. I haven't looked it up. I just remember from my own contact with him. And I admire Alan Grayson. I think he is a remarkable guy. I think he'll get back in office. He is very energetic, and he's really staying on it. I really respect him. And anything you have to say, I'd be glad to hear.
Well, Monday we'll talk with Peter Shores to find out how the redistricting is and what his odds are for having a decent shot at getting elected. We'll find out on Monday.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Wade. Lawrence's call, too, brings up a good point, and one I've talked about before. As I mentioned, I'm uncomfortable with the 1%, 99%. But anytime you put people in little boxes and assume they fit a mold, you're in trouble. You know, I've said this before, I hate when people talk about, oh, the Republicans this, or the Democrats this, or the liberals this. Nobody fits in those perfect little boxes that we want to put them in. You have to start looking at people as individuals, whether it's candidates or the people you deal with day to day. You have to look at people for who they are, because nobody's 100% anything. Obviously, Republican and Democrat are party affiliations, but we use them like slurs in the media. Like, oh, the I was listening to a show actually on our station late last night. It came in from the national stream, and this host was just as guilty. The Democrats, and he says it like he's saying, you know, the Satanists. And that's not a good thing. You know,
had a good Satan show on this station for a long time. You're live on the air.
Would that include Mitt Romney?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but if he's talking about not categorizing somebody with labels, absolutely. And I've said it before. I don't really think Mitt Romney's that much worse than Obama. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not impressed with President Obama. He has told the same lies, taken the same corporate money, but then you also have to look at real facts. There's one that's been a big thing. Everybody's talking about Obama's spending. Well, when you actually look at the hard facts, he's not spent money the way that, you know, his opposition spends it. But then he turns around and he spins the whole thing about, you know, Romney didn't make any jobs. Then they come back with, well, Romney did make jobs. But then they come back with, well, Romney made jobs at Domino's Pizza and Sports Authority. It's just never ending, the slurs and the slamming people with stuff. You know, it's, as a voter, everybody out there, it's your responsibility to find the facts, not the media spin, not the propaganda.
So how about the new radio dog that's here today?
I know. You never know who's coming to visit. There's a pup here today.
That is a solid dog.
I have to assume that Radio Rabbit's in his cage. I don't think the dog and the rabbit.
If Radio Rabbit is smart.
Stranger things have happened, but I'm not seeing that dog and the rabbit being buddies.
I had a dog similar to that. It was like, you would smack him upside the head just to get his attention. It didn't hurt him.
That didn't sound really good.
No, well, it's just the way it was. You know, you're 80 pounds, you're all muscle, and you got a head the size of a basketball. You know, you got to get their attention some way. And, you know, he was like, what's that? And anyway.
Yeah, some breeds are smarter than others. I used to have a husky. He was pretty. God, he was pretty. Not real bright.
Isn't a corgi a little dog?
A corgi?
Corgi.
With a G.
I don't know what you're saying.
You mean like the queen has?
Yeah.
Corgi with a G. It's C-O-R-G-I. Corgi.
Whatever.
They're smaller. They're not like Maltese or Chihuahuas, but they're smaller.
We got a 65-pound dog, and when I look at her, I see Chow, and I see either Rottweiler markings or Doberman markings. And my wife said, she's a corgi. What? I had to go Scooby-Doo.
You can look them up online. They're from what I understand, they're good little dogs. I've not had any firsthand
experience. Big old dog! Anyway, 9/11 truther leading Egyptian presidential race. An Islamist who believes that the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States were an American conspiracy is the front runner in Egyptian's presidential race, a new poll shows. Abdel Munim Batfato, formerly a leading figure in the Muslim Brotherhood, led the field of 13 candidates with 32% of the vote in a survey released Monday by the Washington-based Brookings Institution, who must have their finger on the pulse of the Egyptian people. Mr. Abdel-Fattah expressed his views on the September 11, 2000 attack on the World Trade Center in the Pentagon in an interview last year with Egyptian scholar Eric Traeger. Oh, well, we're about out of time. Which one do I want to do here? Pilgrim nuclear power station shut down. Entergy plant will remain shut until investigators figure out what happened. I think that's a good plan. Officials say the Pilgrim nuclear power station in Plymouth has been shut down after a malfunction of a machine that cools the steam the reactor produces and converts it into water. Neil Sheehan, spokesman for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, said a condenser at the plant lost its vacuum pressure He tells the Boston Globe that the condenser operates in a vacuum to maximize efficiency. Officials said the incident happened about 1:10 p.m. Tuesday when the plant was operating at about 30% capacity. Yeah, there's other stories here. Alarm over arming our domestic drones. Why not? Put some heavy firepower on those things. There was something of... Oh, this is what... Shock poll from Quinnipiac in Florida. Romney leads Obama 47% to 41%. Romney was preferred by 40% to Obama's 41% among a random telephone survey of 1,722 registered Florida voters conducted between May 15th and May 24th by the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute. Poll's margin of error is plus or minus 2.4 percentage point. Survey also indicated that having Senator Marco Rubio of Miami on the Republican ticket with Romney would have little effect on voter decisions. Romney led Obama 49% to 41% with Rubio as his running mate. This 13-point shift for Mitt Romney since late March, the Obama campaign still have issues with Florida independent voters. Well, we've managed to roll through another hour, Robin. And the cool edit continues to work, so we will have a podcast up today, which I was a little bit worried about earlier in the day.
Yeah, I don't know what they did to that. I don't know. I don't know what they were doing to the 64. They were not nice to it last night. Mick, be nice to this computer. We need it in the morning.
Yeah. Or break out the Atari. I think we're going to have to go back to that. Tomorrow, Jim Delgado in the studio. Robin Davis will be in the studio. I expect to be in the studio.
And I don't know. Is there a lottery drawing tonight? Because if there is, you know, I can't make any promises.
No, that was last night.
Oh, then I should joke. I should have bought a ticket, I guess.
I have the numbers that I have been playing for whatever how many years it is.
Clearly not working out for you.
No. But at least when I forgot to buy the ticket last night and I looked, it wasn't the numbers. So
I know a woman who played the same numbers every day for decades, and that she actually, her numbers won on a day she didn't buy it. She carried that newspaper clipping with her, laminated, the rest of her life.
You're live on the air. Quickly.
Just want to let you know that the lottery is a tax on people who are bad at math.
And that is true. It's a bad investment. It's fun to fantasize, but it's a really bad investment.
I just feel it's like my contribution back to the state of Florida.
Yeah, okay.